Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today marks the 70th anniversary of one of the most momentous events of the 20th century, and that is the invasion of Poland by Nazi German troops, the Wehrmacht, going across the Polish border. Now, what that really marked was the beginning of the great event we know as World War II, that cataclysm that involved some 5/6 of the world's surface in warfare, especially focused on the European theater and the Pacific theater. By the time World War II was over, the world was literally transformed. The map was redrawn politically and geographically, and of course, entire peoples had been transferred, moved. Nations had suffered so grievously. And of course, we came to find out at the end of the war that there had been a Holocaust in which millions of Jews had been exterminated in Nazi camps. But what's really going on in terms of the year 2009 with the 70th anniversary is the fact that there are many people who are beginning to look back and say, what was the meaning of World War II? This is a think program today, folks. I'm going to invite you to think with me. And the question is, what was the meaning of World War II? Looking back from 70 years of the precipitating event that led to the event we know as World War II, how do you interpret this? Now, by the way, I'd be fascinated to know what people of different generations think about this. There are persons listening to this program right now who are veterans of World War II. You were in uniform on the front lines or in that great mass of people mobilized both domestically and internationally on behalf of the Allied cause in World War II. God bless you. I'd love to know what you're thinking right now about the meaning of World War II. There are the sons and daughters of that generation and successive generations, and right now, all across America, there are high school, college, even middle school students and younger who are studying about World War II in school, and the question of the meaning of history comes back again and again and again. What does this mean? Now, one of the reasons why we need to have this discussion is that in the last year, not one, but two books have been written suggesting that World War II was an unnecessary war. Authors Nicholson Baker and the better-known Pat Buchanan both wrote books within the last year or so arguing that World War II was an unnecessary war. This is not just a political or historical question. This is a moral question. It's the kind of question that requires intelligent thought. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation about the things that matter. And on the 70th anniversary of the Nazi invasion of Poland, hey, it matters, because the world we're living in right now has been shaped by those events. And one of the things we have to wonder is whether or not we could be setting up something of the same phenomenon all over again. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. What is the meaning of World War II? Young, old, and in between. Love to have you call. You can always write us at mail@albertmohler.com. You can follow on Twitter by /AlbertMohler or Mohler Radio. And, of course, at Facebook, the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to get to that in first a review of some issues in the news. Big news in the Bible translation world out today. Zondervan Publishers, along with the Committee on Bible Translation and Biblica, formerly known as the International Bible Society, announced today jointly that there will be a new edition of the New International Version of the Bible, commonly known by its brand, NIV. Now, those who hear those words will know that this is coming years after a very, very hot, controversial period of debate over the emergence of what was known as the TNIV, still on shelves now, today's New International Version. And the issues of controversy back then, especially in 2002 and in neighboring years, was over the issues and decisions that framed the TNIV, especially the decision to use what they claimed, those behind the translation claimed, were efforts at what they called gender accuracy. There were many of us, and I certainly was among those, who were the critics of that new translation, precisely because we felt that it did not lead to greater accuracy, but instead a lamentable inaccuracy. It was a controversy worth having. It wasn't always debated on the right terms. It wasn't always debated in the right spirit, but it was a debate that had to happen. In response to the threats by many that they would see the NIV as unstable and untrustworthy in light of these changes, Zondervan Publishers and the Committee on Bible Translation, and then what was known as the International Bible Society, froze the NIV. So that the translation known as the NIV right now, you could go to any bookshelf and in the bookstore and find, is a translation that's now over 20 years old. Well, the partners behind the NIV announced today that they are going to be unfreezing that translation. They froze it back during the period of controversy because they said, we'll call this new translation the TNIV. We won't change the NIV, so don't worry about it. Well, I want to tell you right up front that freezing a translation is not fundamentally a good idea because language changes. And if we really are committed to the translation of the scripture into the vernacular language, that is, into the common, ordinary language spoken by very real human beings, that language changes. And over time, even as that language changes, sometimes fast, sometimes slowly, adjustments have to be made in translations. Now, I've been in conversation with the people who are the partners behind the NIV, and they know very directly of my concerns about the NIV. I appeared on national media in order to make those concerns very clear back when the TNIV was announced and when it was released. Part of that controversy going back to the original days had to do with the way it was handled by the partners behind the NIV. And I want to give them credit. They've made a very clear, public, honest, straightforward announcement today. And they deserve credit for a very public, straightforward, honest, open, transparent announcement. They have not pledged that they will go back and revisit all those translation decisions in a way that, for instance, would lead me to believe they've done the right thing in all cases. Indeed, even as they have pledged to go back and look at every controversy and every disputed passage and every difficult decision in order to seek to get it right, at the same time, they're going to be basing this new edition of what's going to be called the NIV, released in 2011, they're going to base it on the existing text of the TNIV as it has been developed even since its release. So what's the bottom line in all this? Well, I don't know. I don't know. I will tell you this. Evangelicals can disagree on this while still recognizing that this is not an issue in which we really should be suspect of motivations. But it is an issue that calls us to be very, very clear about what we believe a translation should be, how a translation should be done, and what kind of end result we should hope and pray for. So the debate's worth having. And when this new edition of the Bible comes out, it'll have to stand on its own and be judged on its merits. And if indeed it's just kind of a slightly revised version of the TNIV, well, we'll know that's what it is. If it indeed is a version of the NIV that is very clear and accurate and we believe has handled these things well, no translation can claim to be perfect. None of us is perfect. No committee of Bible translators is perfect. No publisher is perfect. No printer is perfect. What we owe each other right now is the grace of hoping for the very best motivations and accepting each other's word that each is trying to do the very best. And what we need to do right now is to wait and to pray and to hope that indeed what comes out of this will be a translation that we can all recognize is faithful and accurate and trustworthy. I have to hope that. To fail to hope that would be to fail at a very important Christian responsibility. I've written a statement about the new NIV announcement. It's found on my website at albertmiller.com. And what I'm really trying to say in that statement is the issues related to the TNIV, every one of them remains. They were important then, they are important now. But at the same time, we have to hope and pray the best out of this new project. And I certainly hope that the Committee on Bible Translation and Biblica and Zondervan, as they work together, we'll produce a product that we'll all be proud to read and to hold and to recognize as a valid and trustworthy translation. There's so much at stake here. People look at it and say it's market share for translation. People look at it and say, you know, it's a publisher's interest. People look at it and say it's the scholarly reputation interest of those who are involved in the translation. Yes, it's all those things. But it also is, indeed, the stewardship of translating the Word of God so that people can read those words and be saved. and can look to this translation as totally trustworthy, so that the inerrant and infallible Word of God is indeed translated in a way that is, yes, accurate and faithful and trustworthy. No one said it's easy, but on the other hand, who would rightly aim for anything less? We're going to be coming back to talk about the meaning of World War II. What was that war all about? Was it necessary or unnecessary? Amazing claims being made about it now, 7 decades after the Nazi invasion of Poland that took place on September the 1st, 1939. So near and yet so far. We'll be right back with the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. This is one of those questions that really causes us to think. It is a good thing. 7 decades after the invasion of Poland, the start of World War II, we need to ask some questions. What was the meaning of that war? And here we are in 2009. You look at the world situation. We've got hotspots, North Korea. Of course, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We've got the threat of a nuclear Iraq. You've got all kinds of things. You have all kinds of diplomacy going on. We're in a rewritten world in terms of the map since 1945 and the end of World War II. But interestingly enough, in the last year or so, a couple of books have emerged. Nicholson Baker wrote a book really questioning whether World War II had been necessary and suggesting that maybe indeed it was not, that it was a futile effort. And then on the other hand, you have Pat Buchanan writing from a somewhat isolationist position, but certainly making very clear that he thinks America should have just stayed out of World War II. The big question, you look back at it now, is, well, how would the world have been different if that had not gone the way it did? Now, we're not talking today about counterfactual history. We're not trying to go back and rewrite history. We're asking the question, what was the meaning of what did happen? Well, what lessons should be learned from World War II? And for Christians thinking about this, this gets to issues about just war and the necessity of meeting a threat like Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. It leads to some of the most difficult issues in the conduct of war on both sides. I mean, one of the things that Americans and British folk have never really faced are the moral questions related to the bombings that took place, especially within Germany itself. And there are big questions both at the beginning of the war and the end of the war. One of the things, by the way, we need to note about the invasion of Poland is that it did become the precipitating factor to start World War II because of the Nazi invasion. It was a guarantee of Poland's protection and sovereignty over against the Nazi threat that led Britain and France into a treaty that required them, upon the Nazi invasion of Poland, to enter into a war with Germany. But on the very same day, in a concerted effort, not only did Nazi Germany invade Poland, but the Soviet Union invaded Poland, because there had been a premeditated agreement to divide it up. So the Poles today are thinking not only of Nazi aggressors, but also of Soviet aggressors. But World War II happened, and the scale of that war is almost difficult to imagine. At the end of the war, 60 million persons have been killed. That's 60 million persons. That is a population larger than several of the nations involved in the war in terms of their total population. And by the way, that is an estimate that could only be increased if we had the knowledge of deaths far beyond those that were recorded and calculated as direct consequences of the war. By the time the war was over, some 5/6 of the world's surface had been involved in this war, at least as nations were represented. And there were two giant theaters in this war, the European theater and then the Pacific theater. America's entry into the war in 1941 changed the course of the war, but many Americans really are kind of blissfully unaware of the fact that the war had been ongoing for at least 2 years before we entered that great global catastrophe. Then on the other side of history, we also need to recognize that as the World War II generation is passing from us, the moral questions related to this war, the lessons learned from this war, could be lost in ways that would be both to impoverish ourselves and to endanger ourselves. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. What were the lessons of World War II? I think that's a very big question. It's one of those questions that would be really very productively discussed in a history seminar on the college university campus. But it's also the kind of conversation that could take place in a barbershop or just in any neighborhood gathering place or even where you've got school kids involved who say, you know, that's a question. That's a good question. I want you to join the question by calling me at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Ken Burns' series, The War, really helped a lot of Americans even about a year ago to understand something of the nature of that war. It was a very well-produced series, but it could tell only a minute portion of the story. That's one of the challenges of talking about World War II. It is such a huge event in world history. There is virtually no way that anyone in any book or any program or any history can gain the conception of the whole. You know, one of the interesting things about World War II is that as we look backwards at the 20th century, it becomes clear that it's probably wrong to talk about World War II. We talk about two separate wars, the First World War and the Second World War. But the reality is that historians are more and more coming to the conclusion that it was really one great world conflagration, one great war separated by an artificial peace between 1918 and 1939. When you look at a map and you look at the nations that were at war in the First World War, you look at an overlay of the nations that were at war in the Second World War, by and large the same. The map is hauntingly familiar. And when you look at that, you recognize, evidently, at the end of World War I, they declared a victory that wasn't a settled reality. And as soon as the Germans could rearm and get re-equipped for battle, and once it was under the direction of the Nazi Party and the Fuhrer, Adolf Hitler, it was ready to go back to war with a vengeance. And indeed, to use the resentment of the end of World War I and the Treaty of Versailles in order to rally the German people to what was envisioned as Germany's national destiny. There are an awful lot of lessons to be learned here. What do you do when you see a threat like Nazi Germany? You know, what do you do when you look out on the horizon and you see a threat like that? The American people saw the threat. The British people saw the threat. The French certainly saw the threat. The French are always looking across the German border and historically seeing a threat. Germany and France had been at war in the Franco-Prussian War just a matter of decades before World War I. And, of course, you've got Russia and Germany that have always been very, very uncomfortable partners in the east of Europe. You start to look at all this and you recognize that, especially speaking of the Americans and the British, there was a keen eye upon Germany. There was an observation that Germany was rearming, violating the terms of the Versailles Agreement. There was the rearmament of especially the area closest to France. And even as there was the reindustrialization of Germany, it was clear that this new capacity is being accompanied by political leadership in the form of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party that had imperialist ambitions and saw war as an instrument of national policy. One of the lessons I would suggest to World War II is that appeasement just doesn't work. Classically, you look back to Neville Chamberlain, and you think back to September of 1938, to just barely 11 months, because it was at the end of September in 1938 when he met with Hitler in Munich and signed the Munich Accord and came back and declared to the British people he had accomplished peace in our time. Here's one of the questions. What does World War II tell us about the reality of evil in the world? Even back in 1938, there were a lot of people who wanted to believe, desperately wanted to believe, that Hitler was a man that could be reasoned with. That indeed, despite what he'd written in Mein Kampf and what he had been telling to the German people and what he was demonstrating in terms of the remilitarization of Germany, he was a man who could be persuaded. Neville Chamberlain came back from Munich absolutely convinced that he had persuaded Mr. Hitler to forego his war aims. By the way, at the sacrifice of Czechoslovakia, a lot to be considered here. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. 7 decades after the Nazi invasion of Poland, what do these things mean? We'll be right back.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We are talking today on the 70th anniversary of the opening of World War II. It was not declared for two more days, but the originating event that sparked the conflagration known as World War II was the Nazi invasion of Poland on September 1, 1939. I want you to hear this original broadcast from the British Broadcasting Corporation. Now remember, when you hear this, that the British people are in full awareness that the invasion of Poland requires their government to declare war on Nazi Germany.
The following official communique has been issued from 10 Downing Street. On September the 1st, His Majesty's ambassador in Berlin was instructed to inform the German government that unless they were prepared to give His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom satisfactory assurances that the German government had suspended all aggressive action against Poland and were prepared promptly to withdraw their forces from Polish territory, His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom would, without hesitation, fulfill their obligations to Poland.
Then followed the announcement from British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain.
This is London. You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
And it was. And of course also then France, and then roughly 2 years later, the United States, in what was genuinely a world war. We're asking the question, what does World War II mean? And of course now 7 decades after the Nazi invasion of Poland that became the catalyst for the beginning of this war, it is necessary for us to look back and recognize that this war should have been seen, and indeed was seen. And we have to go back and ask the questions, could it have been prevented? Or at least, could it have been averted or shortened by earlier action? How do we read those events? The phone number is 877-893-8255. Let's go to Mount Washington, Kentucky. James is on the line. Go ahead, James.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Robert. I would like to say that I think the lesson to learn before this is just simply to stand our own moral values. If we perceive something as a threat or dangerous, we need to act on it. In detail, we were turning a blind eye to Hitler because we were more worried about the Russians and Stalin, and Germany was looking the other way. That's why they were allowing the buildup and not really saying anything. And unfortunately, by just turning a blind eye, we kind of got, you know, ourselves, our own country, we got hit while we weren't looking. So I'm just thinking if there's an issue there, we need to at least anyway address it personally and not depend on anybody else to fight our own battles for us.
A very interesting point, James. You know, when you go back to the Second World War, one of the interesting things is that the people who were most determined to stay out of this war tended to be the American people. And as a matter of fact, when Franklin Roosevelt was elected president, he had to make promises that he would not take your boys to war. That's what he said to America's mothers as he was running for president. And the reality is that after World War I, there was such an isolationism amongst the American people that that even as almost anyone should have seen, and there was ample documentation of what was going on in Germany, the American people simply would not allow the mobilization. When you start going back, you realize that that there were enormous inadequacies in the United States that were only nearly miraculously overcome by the industrial might of this country after we actually got into the war. And in the months preceding, when it was clear that inevitability was written on the wall in terms of the war. James makes a very interesting point. You know, the United States did for some time allow France and Britain to fight this battle in the European theater largely alone. And the reality is that Britain held out very, very courageously In retrospect, it looks like France did not. One of the most poignant events in the early years of the war was Winston Churchill, for the second day in a row, getting on a plane in very dangerous circumstances and flying to France to try to convince the provisional government there to stay in the fight. What we're looking at is the reality that we can now look back and say things should have been clearer. Not only the leaders, but the American people should have seen more clearly the threat. And if so, perhaps there would not have been the appeasement of Hitler. Perhaps we would not have looked the other way. I want to know what you think. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. What is the meaning of World War II? 7 decades later. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. We're talking about World War II, 7 decades later. It's fascinating to look back. September 1, 1939, the Nazi invasion, also, as we just to clarify, also the Soviet invasion of Poland, one from the west, one from the east. And a nation was sacrificed. I just have to tell you a quick story. In 1986, Mary and I were in London, and I was doing some study at Oxford University, and we were there, and it was a very cold winter. And she was looking at some shops and things, and we had visited some museums, and I was walking towards the neighborhood of Kensington, and I was in the diplomatic area, and there came a freezing rain, and I just stepped up under the stoop of one of these buildings, and I was in front of this very ornate door, not far from the American Embassy, and it had this incredible two-winged eagle spread on the door, and there was a doorman. And as I just stepped under the canopy to avoid the weather, this rather elderly doorman opened the door and bid me to come in. So I walked in, and I was in Poland. I was in the Polish embassy. This is 1986. This is during the Cold War. This was not the embassy of the Polish government recognized by the Soviet Union. This was the Polish government that had been in exile continuously, relocated in terms of its government to Britain since September the 1st, 1939. Elderly men in formal wear with the Imperial Polish flag. You know, I'm turning 50 this year, and it's amazing. I look back to this and recognize that I had a personal touch just for the briefest of moments there in London with people whose lives were defined by what happened 70 years ago today. An act of defiance, by the way. Isn't that marvelous? It's just a tremendous act of defiance that the government just relocated to London and said, well, this is still Poland. This is still a government. And we will one day return. I've often wondered what those old men thought if indeed they lived long enough to see the fall of the Iron Curtain and Poland reemerge as a nation. One of the interesting things we have to see when we look back to 1945 and the end of the war, and further back to 1939 and the beginning of the war, is that history is made up not so much of inevitabilities, but of the consequences of decisions and actions undertaken by very real human beings. And when you look at World War II, that is certainly true. One of the human beings involved there is a name that is now infamous. You heard his voice a few moments ago. That was the then Prime Minister of Great Britain, Neville Chamberlain. He has been known as the Prophet of Appeasement. Now, in some cases, that is probably overblown as a judgment because Neville Chamberlain would, if he were alive, jump to his own defense and say, appeasement was the only option for a country that was as unmilitarized and unready for war as was Great Britain in the 1930s. But the verdict of history has been very, very tough on Neville Chamberlain, and the verdict on history came very, very fast. As a matter of fact, the verdict of history landed on Neville Chamberlain on September the 1st, 1939. He thought he had convinced Hitler not to invade Poland. He came back on September the 30th, 1938, and told the British people he had convinced Herr Hitler, Mr. Hitler, not to invade Poland. But Nazi Germany invaded Poland. And this is what Neville Chamberlain had to say as Prime Minister in light of that invasion.
You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have arranged a peaceful and honorable settlement between Germany and Poland. But Hitler would not have it. Now, may God bless you all, and may he defend the right. For it is evil things that we shall be fighting against. Brute force, bad faith, injustice, oppression, and persecution. And against them, I am certain that the right will prevail.
Neville Chamberlain there giving his basic address of defeat in his approach to appeasement. By the way, one of the aspects to that approach was that it's hardly been admitted that those who signed the Munich Agreement sacrificed Czechoslovakia. That they just gave an entire nation to Hitler that had no choice or nor voice in itself. The verdict of history has not been good to Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, because one of the lessons that was learned from World War II is that the appeasement of evil just does not work. Negotiating with the non-negotiable is a recipe for disaster. And you have to wonder about the application of that today. You really do. You have to wonder about the application of that same principle to those whose answer to everything is diplomacy, when that diplomacy changes nothing. Whether it's North Korea or Iran right now in terms of nuclear ambitions, it's a clear question. Not exactly the same circumstance. You can't just bring history forward and say it's exactly the same thing. But lessons must be learned. By the way, I think one of the greatest biographies of all time is the two volumes written by William Manchester about Winston Churchill, The Last Lion. I wish we had the third volume, but William Manchester was incapacitated and then died before he could finish the third volume. So what we have are the years of Winston Churchill leading up to when he took over as prime minister. In the brilliant first chapter of that biography, so eloquently and powerfully written, William Manchester paints the picture of 1939 and 1940 and points out that Britain is in a desperate situation. It is unlikely that it will be able to survive. It says his only hope is that there will be a leader that will be able to rally the people against this very real threat. He paints the picture in all of its darkness, and then he says, very simply, at the end of that chapter, in London, there was such a man. When you hear these words, you'll understand why. This is Prime Minister Winston Churchill, soon after taking office, speaking on the 4th of June, 1940.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, our British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
There you hear Winston Churchill. And of course, as history looks back to Winston Churchill, it's recognized that it was his leadership that was instrumental in keeping Britain alive during the war. And to a degree, many have not recognized keeping America alert as well. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. Interesting questions. Just a few thoughts I want to throw out here at the end about the meaning of World War II. We've talked about some of the obvious things about the moral danger of trying to appease those who would do great evil. And of course, the Nazi invasion of Poland was evil. And if you actually knew the brutality of what went on in that invasion, and the Wehrmacht, and of course also the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, in terms of the carnage that it brought about, the ruthless carnage. But, of course, there are other issues there, not only the territorial ambitions of Germany, but, of course, its ideology of racial cleansing and racial superiority. I mean, basically, World War II, as it was delayed until the 1930s, the late 1930s, through decisions that seemed purely rational and right to those in power at the time, nonetheless allowed for the entire creation of this infrastructure of genocide against the Jewish people. And you look back and you say, well, those who were alive at the time making those decisions do bear some historical responsibility, moral accountability for those actions. And then, of course, we've just been talking here about mostly the European theater because it's simply too large an issue to take on the Pacific theater at the same time. But there was some appeasement going on there as well. And as with any situation in a sinful world, there were wrongs on both sides, such that there were original grievances that if they'd been taken seriously, especially after the Treaty of Versailles, it could have led to a very different result. You had at the end of World War I a hardening of hearts, a framing of national resentments that now in retrospect seemed almost inevitably to lead to World War II. There are other lessons there too, because as we look back to World War II, let's be thankful that the Nazi Empire was defeated. It's hard to imagine a world in which we could want to live in which the Nazi ambitions were realized. But at such a cost. 60 million lives. And at such a moral cost as well, because Americans and the Allies found themselves doing things in that war that we had thought we would never do. The bombing of large civilian populations and all the rest. This is not to suggest a sense of moral equivalence between Nazi Germany and the Allies. That would be moral nonsense, an absolute moral desecration. But it is to say that in a fallen world, not only does war become lamentably inevitable, but it is inevitably as horrible as human beings and their sinfulness can make it. Looking back at September the 1st, 1939, we need to be humble historians to take the measure of that event and do everything within our power to say never again. But in a fallen world, it turns out that the same questions often come back again and again. Our only hope is to be given the wisdom and the courage to answer those questions and to confront those events more clearly, more adequately than those who came before us. I'll meet you tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.